me what's happening, what's the buzz? Tell me what's happening, what's the buzz? Tell me what's happening, what's the buzz? Tell me what's happening, what's the buzz? We're here. We are at the Center for Wooden Boats at South Lake Union for KUOW's Week in Review. And as you can hear, we have a lively live audience. Hey, everybody. Thanks for coming down. Yeah, we had a little bit of rain this morning, but I think all the hydrophobic people were not going to come to the Center for Wooden Boats anyway. So we've got we have a hearty crew. By the way, if you are fairly new to Seattle, sometimes we'll hear from someone who says, who doesn't understand what we talk about when we say the changing Lake Union. You know, this is just, if you're new here, this is just another hot spot, right? Amazon, Gates Foundation, condos and retail and restaurants and your basic nerve center. But if your back is as mossy as ours, then you have seen the metamorphosis. What is your one-word take on today's South Lake Union? One word, and then you can expound. We have lots of good answers to that on Facebook at KUOW Public Radio. You can join the discussion there. Joining the discussion here at the Center for Wooden Boats, our panel, our guests, our friends, Knute Berger is the Mossback at crosscut.com and a columnist at Seattle Magazine. Hey, Knute.
Hey, Bill.
South Lake Union, in one word to you?
Well, it's a name, Paul Allen.
Allentown?
There you go.
Joni Balter, host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel, columnist for Bloomberg View. South Lake Union in one word, Joni?
Well, I don't want Sherman to hit me here, but my one word is Amazon.
Well, we will get into that. Sherman happens to be published by Hachette. Who are we talking about? Just one of the premier authors in the country, and we're so lucky to have him here. Sherman Alexie, welcome.
Thank you. Yes, I don't know how to swim, so I'm wearing a life jacket.
Do you think you could craft, for all the words that you've written, could you break off one word for South Lake Union?
Chipotle.
Chipotle. Give us your feedback at Facebook, KUOW Public Radio, Twitter at KUOW. What's the hashtag, Bond? At SLU?
SLU Live.
Hashtag SLU Live. You can always give us a call on the phone, 206-685-2526. That is 685-BLAM. Okay, let's begin, unfortunately, with what I think we have all been thinking about this week. This is KUOW's Week in Review, where we are recapping, analyzing, and sort of figuring out what we've learned from the week gone by. And across the country, and really in Seattle, too, we're thinking about the shooting of an unarmed black teenager in Ferguson, Missouri, the protests, and the police response. So the latest I've seen this morning, maybe you can update me, but police have released the name of the officer, right? Who shot and killed Michael Brown. They've released the incident report, according to which a convenience store clerk called 911 and reported what the report called a strong-armed robbery of some cigars. Police released still photos, at least, maybe some video, of a tall, dark-skinned man apparently in a physical scuffle with a clerk. Now, the report names Michael Brown as a suspect and says that's why he was stopped by police. The officer says Brown resisted the stop and struggled physically with the officer, who felt threatened. At least one witness says no, Michael Brown was shot trying to run away. There have been peaceful protests. There have been some bottle and rock throwing protests. Police claim they saw Molotov cocktails. The St. Louis County Police looked like a military unit. They used tear gas. They used rubber bullets, even on peaceful demonstrators. There were armored vehicles. They aimed assault rifles. Detained journalists took down TV cameras. Critics call this a military-style crackdown. President Obama denounced the excessive force. Now, before we talk about the Seattle connection, anything to fill in there? Did I sum it up about right?
You did a beautiful job there. Yes.
That's what we know.
Yes.
So we have had experience with this in Seattle, right? What came to mind when you saw all these images of...
Well, what came to mind was WTO and how that, all of a sudden, everybody who was in the downtown streets remember when the cops came out in those ninja outfits. Mm-hmm. And then I happened to be on 6th Avenue. A lot of folks were. The second that tear gas was lobbed, I was standing there with a whole bunch of journalists, and one of them said to me, and this was shocking to me, he says, "So Paul Schell's going to be a one-term mayor." Like, he said it within 2 minutes. Mm-hmm. But we all learned from that the police dressed like that, acting like that, behaving like that, did not turn anything down. It turned everything up. And that is, for me, just watching the same thing, what you learn from something like this.
Former Seattle Police Chief Gil Kerlikowske talked about, he came in after the original riots. He was there for the one-year anniversary of WTO, and then in 2001, remember, the Mardi Gras riots, and Police Chief Kerlikowske told NPR's Steve Inskeep that he regrets sending police out to the Mardi Gras situation in riot gear.
To tell you the truth, it makes it pretty difficult when you're talking from behind a face shield with a gas mask to engage with the public and say, look, let's tone this down, let's calm things down, let's make sure that those people that need to be apprehended or arrested because of their intoxicated state, their level of violence, et cetera. It's pretty hard to engage in those discussions when you're hardened up.
Canute, isn't that a hard call for police to make when they are in the middle of vandalism, looting, rock throwing, and the police are targets?
It is, and I don't think WTO and what happened in Ferguson are entirely parallel. To me, the most compelling images were the ones, I think, in the New York Times this morning that were juxtaposing pictures from Ferguson with pictures from the civil rights era in 1963 in Alabama and Mississippi. And I think that the part of the message is that what happened in Ferguson, this is somewhat of a flashpoint, but this stuff is happening all over the country. It's happening in Florida. It's happening in Seattle. And even a progressive city like this is struggling to get policing right. I mean, we're under federal mandate to not use as much violence as we have. And so police departments are kind of having to learn and in some cases relearn how to be part of the community they're policing and not alienated from that community, not alienating elements of that community. And that's a tough thing. And it's especially tough when you have this trend that's been going on certainly since the Clinton years, if not before, of a slow militarization of the police departments. They can get federal grants to buy military equipment.
Is that because of wars on terror and drugs?
You know, it began before that. And Joni mentioned WTO. If you look at the after-action reports that the police and law enforcement consultants did, they basically said the problem wasn't enough force was used and that they were basically ascribing to peaceful protesters the same kind of tactics that they ascribe to guerrilla warfare in Somalia. In other words, they're beginning to think of urban environments as war zones and reacting that way. And I think it's really out of proportion. And I think Ferguson's showing that if you bring in the state troopers who, in this case, know how to de-escalate, you can at least get to the point where people can talk to one another.
Yeah, it became a very different mood, right, Sherman, after they put the state patrol in charge of this instead of the St. Louis County Police?
Well, and certainly when they had, I forget his name, the big guy, the big boss walking with them, who was a black man, walking with the protesters, that image itself immediately, certainly nationally, made us all feel better watching that man do that. You know, I don't really think, I mean, in terms of the police reaction, there may be a comparison between the WTO and what's happening in Ferguson. But the racial aspect is completely missing from WTO. You know, it was in Seattle, and it was very white. It was a lot of white people getting assaulted by white cops. The racial aspect of it was almost entirely missing. And certainly there are no long-lasting images in the United States of white protesters of any sort being assaulted by police like we have of black people being assaulted. So, you know, images from the 1960s in Birmingham with dogs and militarized police. So I think the images themselves played a large part, and the readily access to the images now with technology really played a part in escalating the situation.
Yeah, well, you saw some of those flares and all those things going on. It looked like Ukraine to me for a second. I looked at the New York Times picture and was like, wait a minute, is this the U.S.? It didn't look anything like it.
Norm Stamper, another former Seattle police chief, said he told the news site Vox.com, there's a real place for dogs in police work, but it is not in the context of a nonviolent protest. In fact, using dogs for crowd control is operationally, substantively, and from an image point of view, just about the worst thing you can do. We should have learned that lesson, as you said, Canute, as an institution back in the 60s in this country. Former Chief Pugel has weighed in on this. I haven't heard our current police chief, Kathleen O'Toole, yet coming out commenting publicly.
Well, one of the interesting things among my friends, and we're a mix in Seattle of fairly conservative Republicans to crazy commies like me, and our response to what's going on there has all been exactly the same. There's been a total bipartisan condemnation of the police state. My more conservative, paranoid libertarian friends see it as what's going to happen to them. Even though it's not,
Rand Paul came in and criticizing the police force.
Exactly, their whole ethos is built on this is going to happen to white people, and it doesn't.
That's where we have to draw the line.
Exactly.
Well, I think O'Toole's probably smart not to comment on it simply because she's actually a police chief. Functioning, she's not retired,
right,
as these other gentlemen are there, and so they're more free to criticize because something bad's going to happen here in Seattle eventually, because it always does. It's just, she's going to be tested by what her response is.
Well, something bad happened in Westlake Mall a few days ago during a protest about Gaza, when a mall security guard intervened in an altercation between a white man and a black man and tear gassed maced the black man who was just there and decided not to mace the shirtless white man yelling racial insults at the protesters. So, I think it's kind of a rule of mine to mace the shirtless guy in any altercation.
Good rule of thumb.
That could be like a slogan or a book title or something. Mace the shirtless
Sherman
guy.
Alexi, Joni Balter, Canute Berger with us on KUOW's Week in Review, live at the Center for Wooden Boats. We've got a live audience with us, and you there at home or at work or in the car. Coming up, Amazon, whose shadow we are in here in South Lake Union, has been good to Seattle. Should you support them back no matter what? Sherman Alexi. And others, that's coming up next. KUOW's Week in Review. Good morning. I'm Bill Radke with Canute Berger, Joni Balter, and Sherman Alexi. We're live in front of a live audience here at the beautiful Center for Wooden Boats on the beautiful Lake Union in the shadow of Amazon. This week, the long-running fight between Amazon and a major publisher reached a full-page letter in the New York Times. As I think you know, Amazon and publisher Hachette, well, they're having a private spat. It's generally believed that Amazon is trying to get Hachette to charge less for its e-books by making the new Hachette titles unavailable for pre-order and by slowing the delivery of older titles. Since then, Amazon has also been using similar negotiating tactics with Disney and others with their DVDs. I believe, which DVD? It's escaped me. The Muppet Movie for
the
one.
The Lego Movie.
And the Lego Movie. Now, more than 900 writers, some of them bestsellers, one of them sitting 10, 20 feet from me, have taken out an open letter in the New York Times denouncing Amazon for, quote, harming the livelihood of the authors on whom it has built its business. Sherman Alexi, what has Amazon ever done to you?
Well, in the last 6 months, they've cost me a lot of money. But that's
okay. How much is a lot?
More than all of you make.
That's no way to talk.
You're really making your case there, brother. I feel sorry for you now.
But that's the thing that is easy to dismiss us for, that it's successful writers doing this. But what Amazon, and it's not about the money. I mean, if I was concerned about the money, I would be in Amazon's pocket. I mean, I rent an office space in South Lake Union. I see the blue ID tagged Amazon people all day long. So it would be easy for me to be a partner with Amazon. So it's not about money. It's about the health of the industry as a whole and the diversity of the industry. And Amazon And many of us have been saying this for years now. I've been against Amazon for 8 years. Amazon wants a publishing monopoly. They want to be the absolute seller, the absolute publisher, the absolute publicist. They want to control every aspect of publishing. That is their stated goal. That is their unstated goal. That is their conscious goal. That is their subconscious goal. And when you're talking about books, you're not talking about the vacuum cleaners they sell. You're not talking about shoes. You're talking about ideas. And Amazon wants a monopoly on the distribution of ideas in the whole world. And that's what I'm fighting.
So it's a gutsy move on your part, if you think about it, because I went to the website to see what book ordering might look like if I ordered your book. And I could buy now. We were wrong about that a couple weeks ago. You could buy now, but it usually ships 1 to 3 weeks. All the other books they'll bring to your house in the middle of the night, practically.
With a drone.
Knut, you agree Amazon is a monopoly wannabe?
Well, yeah, and I think some of the creepy practices in this particular dispute that have to do with sort of holding individual authors hostage to a corporate argument, I think, is really awful. But that said, you know, I'm sort of a slave to Amazon myself in terms of it's just so damn convenient, you know, and I've been drawn in. I buy stuff on Amazon all the time, and I hate myself for it.
Well, as long as you hate yourself, the world is a better place.
Well, it fits my Scandinavian psyche, right?
Gotcha. Now, this Amazon-Hachette fight is happening now because they're renegotiating under a court order because the big publishers got caught colluding to force up the price of ebooks. So are publishers not just as self-interested as Amazon?
Of course publishers are just as self-interested, but you're talking about a vast range of people. Different publishers with different philosophies. You're talking about various imprints inside the companies. So you're not talking about some monolith of ideas or even people. You're talking about thousands of people with different interests. And their primary interest is the health of the book industry. I mean, people keep talking like the book industry has been some failure. Like the way we've been doing it and the way it has worked has somehow shortchanged us from all this amazing literature that we've enjoyed now for in the United States since its beginning.
Well, there are self-publishers who say it's working great for the Sherman Alexies of the world, but that Amazon has democratized things.
Democratized what? Nobody self-publishing is making any money either. Amazon certainly doesn't release the numbers, but people have done studies, and there's even fewer people selling books through self-publishing than through traditional publishing. The average self-publisher sells a couple hundred copies. So what it really is, the self-publishing program is really ambitious, really often talented people who want this to happen. So they do it. But what it really is, it's like those loyalty programs at QFC or Safeway, where you walk in there and you buy your food and then you hand them their card and you get the number and then you get the discount. So I think Amazon really thinks of their self-publishing program as a way to instill customer loyalty. If they publish your book, you're going to buy everything from them.
Well, what about the Amazon back at you comment where they said that, you know, all these people are just resisting change, that the same thing happened when paperbacks came out?
And it didn't. And they quoted Orwell in their letter. It's amazing to me that they're so successful when they're so dumb.
Isn't irony a literary device that they're supposed to know about?
Yes. This is the company that a few years ago, because of various copyright issues, removed Orwell's 1984 from everybody's Kindle. Like in the middle of the night, they came into your Kindle. Jeff Bezos snuck in and stole your Orwell back, which should remind everybody who owns a device that you don't own the book. You don't even really own the device in your hand. You're renting. It's a really expensive library. That's all your Kindle is.
If ebooks are cheap, if they're only $9.99, which Amazon wants, it might be bad for some authors who are making a great living. It might be bad for publishers. But why is it bad for everybody else, for readers and the rest of the world?
It's bad because it makes it more difficult for new writers to have a career. Certainly with Eden Lapucki, I was recently on the Colbert Report promoting a first novel by a woman named Eden Lapucki. And the thing is, her book got caught up in this battle. And it's a first novel. Without pre-sales, it was doomed. And through, you know, the Colbert bump and the Sherman
the Alexi bump,
the Alexi pimple on the Colbert bump, Eden's book went crazy. But I'm going to be fine. I'm going to be fine. I will be fine. But the thing is, it's about the development of new voices and new ideas that are going to struggle in this environment. And Amazon is not even remotely interested in any individual title. They're interested in the number of sales in total. And they're not interested in any particular idea. So the fact is that book publishing, when you talk about the independent bookstores, you talk about the small presses, you're talking about liberalism. So what Amazon is doing, purposefully or not, is actually making it harder for liberalism to triumph in the literary world.
We have Sherman Alexie here. Let's welcome David Sedaris, one Hachette author who did not sign that letter. David Sedaris told NPR, you ready, Jason, producer, that you do have other alternatives.
If you don't want to go to a store or if you don't want to use some other website to buy the book, then don't buy the book. Don't do it. Get something else you can get on Amazon, like a toaster or thermal socks. I think they sell those. Go ahead. Don't get my book. Get a flashlight instead.
Now, David may have been dripping with irony there, but what about Barnes & Noble and Powell's and Apple and Books A Million and Half Price Books and Elliott Bay and Third Place and University Bookstore? Do you not, Knut, have many other alternatives to Amazon, which is not a monopoly?
Well, you do right now, but the ecosystem is in trouble. And part of that, I mean, I've all been for variety. I think the more ways you can read, the better. The more access you have, whether it's e-books or hand-printed books or whatever. But I think the Sherman points to the real problem, which is the intention of the monopolist. The intention isn't simply to do good here. It's to create a monoculture within our publishing and literary culture. And I know they would argue against that, but I think that's the effect of the kind of obsession they have with controlling the whole market.
Real quick before we're going to go to our next topic, I just want to go around the table. Does Amazon's being local affect whether you are loyal and supportive of them? Knut?
No.
Joni?
I'd say yes. I'd say it affects you because where are we, folks? We're sitting right here and watching our city change and our state coffers change because they're here.
Sherman Alexie?
No.
You have to ask?
I think it affects me only in the sense that I see them almost every day.
Yes.
And certain, after my appearance on the Colbert Report, actually, I was in a coffee shop here in South Lake Union, and a blue-tagged Amazon person recognized me and mouthed a curse at me.
Oh, which, really?
Which,
wow.
Which it's like made me feel triumphant.
We're in front of Sherman Alexie and Joni Balter and Knut Berger and Bill Radke are in front of a wonderful live audience at the Center for Wooden Boats in the shadow of Amazon. And we're going to talk more about the changes to South Lake Union in a few minutes. But coming up in a moment, dear parents, your child's school is failing. Love the feds. Letter grades in a moment. KUOW's Week in Review, where we recap the big stories of the week and figure out what we have learned. I'm Bill Radke with a panel of three and an audience of, what, 50, 70, 100? Welcome to Center for Wooden Boats. Hi, everybody. Thanks for coming down, and thank you for listening. Our next topic this week, well, prepare to be confused. This week and next, public school parents in the Puget Sound area are getting two letters. One says, dear parents, your child's school is a failure. The other says, dear parents, disregard that other letter. Joni, could you recap what's going on?
Well, I'm going to give it a try here. So as you all remember, No Child Left Behind, it's a 2001 law, George Bush era. Well, it had a lot of fallacies in it, and one of them was that that all schools would be able to meet standards set by the states 100% of the time. Well, that didn't work, and so when President Obama came in and Arne Duncan, they decided to give states a waiver if they, you know, different ways to get out of the sort of clutches of this. And one was if your legislature would allow, and ours did not, for student test scores to be counted in teacher evaluations. And so the legislature spent gobs of time this year trying to fix that. They did not fix that. And so folks are getting these two letters now. And this was the first time in my life that I was grateful for my son, who never brought any letters home. And so I did, you wouldn't be confused by that, because then you wouldn't read the one that says your school is failing and the one that says, not so fast, your school is doing a little better. You have to keep in mind that some of the best schools in the state are going to get these letters that say that they're not doing well. And you really have to use your own sense about it, because you know your teachers, you know how well your student is doing or not doing, for that matter. And so you just have to keep your head on, read the letters, and aim really carefully for the garbage can.
These are the big districts: Bellevue, Federal Way, Issaquah, Kent, Lake Washington, North Shore, Renton, Tacoma, have written this letter saying, we are addressing everybody's needs. We are getting there. Why, first of all, is Washington State the only state that did
Washington
not...
Washington State was the first state.
The first.
There are probably others, yes.
And why did Washington State decide that we don't want to evaluate our teachers with test scores?
Well, this became quite the union issue, if you remember the proceedings in Olympia. The union folks didn't want it. They didn't want their evaluations to be wrapped up in all the student performance. But this just happened to be, and if you remember, Governor Jay Inslee went and pleaded with Arne Duncan and asked him, come on, give us another way to get out of this, because we couldn't get the votes in the legislature.
I didn't mention Seattle. Seattle is there. They are also working the problem, but they're saying, we think we might still be able to get this waiver.
So Seattle is not sending out the second letter, and the reason is because they have a teacher evaluation system that they think might meet the standard and might be okay, and then so they don't want to get caught in the middle of this thing if they can possibly make it through with the evaluations that they do.
I want to hear from Canute and Sherman. I just first want to quote from this second letter that's coming from the school districts. Dear parent or guardian, this is in response, remember, to the letter from the Fed saying your district is failing. These other 28 big local school superintendents write, dear parent or guardian, in March 2014, the U.S. Department of Education declined to renew the state of Washington's Conditional Elementary and Secondary Education Act flexibility waiver for schools receiving Title I Part A funds. Do they not teach topic sentences in schools anymore? You're teaching our kids how to write. And it really stuck the audience in. Canute, any thoughts on this?
I remember you. You was my teacher. You is my teacher.
I hate grading, and that's probably because I never brought home a report card that didn't cause great problems on the parental front. But I just think this points out the whole limit of the concept of grading and having the performance issues tied to issues that are beyond the teacher's control. I mean, I think that's, I mean, part of it is grading is kind of a flawed system anyway, and the emphasis on testing and the way that affects the curriculum. But also, I mean, we're talking about having a universal pre-K in Seattle. The reason is it's addressing a lot of sociological conditions that make meeting these standards difficult for teachers. And I think why would we expect teachers to have to solve all of society's problems in a classroom with 30 kids? It's just not realistic. And so I think the whole thing was very political. Schools began cheating on these tests from the very beginning because the amount of money the school districts were going to get was tied to performance. Well, the easiest way to meet the standards was to change them surreptitiously. To cheat.
I found
that
true when I was in school.
I think our schooling system has a lot of we set up a system where people feel they have to cheat, and I think there are better ways of educating people than that.
Sherman, do you have any opinion on this, despite the fact that your kids are in private school?
My kids were public school in elementary, and for middle school and high school, they're in private schools. One child because of special needs that the public schools have no way of addressing because of budget cuts, and another child who is a incredibly artsy-fartsy dude. Who the public schools' needs and interests they could not meet because of budget cuts. So, and it's interesting for me because a lot of my white liberal friends really ponder and struggle, and our friends at these private schools struggle with their kids at these private schools, and they, you know, fret and you know,
they feel guilty.
They feel guilty, and my wife and I, we're Indians. We don't feel any guilt whatsoever about putting our children in the best school possible. And the thing is, any only reason anybody's ever heard of me is because I fled a horrible, underfunded public school on the res for a much substantially better funded by the state and by the community public school in a farm town. So, you know, I chartered myself in a way. And when it comes to public education, I think conservatives, liberals, moderates, I think everybody is wrong. Now, I certainly don't have any answers, but I saw with my kids in school, I saw horrible, jaded, mean, awful teachers protected by the union. I saw innovative, passionate, interesting teachers abandoned. I see conservatives, you know, screaming about wanting to help everything and then not funding anything. I see them failing to even pretend there's a connection between early childhood education and later success in life. Canute was leading to the thing. I mean, all this stuff is Band-Aids on the real problems. And the real problems is there should be universal preschool, and there should be low-income housing in every neighborhood in every city. And the fact is that schools are better when they have a wide diversity of class and culture, and that'll be better for everybody. But that's not going to happen.
He left his crappy school, and you've heard of him, Sherman Alexie. Yes. He's with us. Joni Balcher, Canute Berger, Bill Radke in the Changing South Lake Union, and we're going to capture that in just a moment with our live audience here at the Center for Wooden Boats. Stay tuned to KUOW's Week in Review. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for joining us. Whether you're hooked to the radio or whether you're sitting a few feet away and you're a part of our smiling, drizzle-braving live audience at the Center for Wooden Boats in South Lake Union. You know, we thought that South Lake Union was a neighborhood on the rise, and then we read in the Seattle Times this week that Paul Allen is selling all of his South Lake Union apartment buildings. But then we read the next paragraph. Allen's real estate company, Vulcan, will use the money from selling all those buildings to build yet more new office and apartment projects in South Lake Union. Now, all of us on this panel have been around here long enough to remember this neighborhood as being barely a neighborhood. It was low-slung, very sleepy, unless you were in the business of auto body work, trophy engraving. And then, Sherman, you reminded me of one.
The video store. In this building that had a Kinko's sign above it that said video store, I think, and it was a door, and you'd go into this room, and they still had VHS copies 5 years ago, and they had a back room with a curtain, the back room curtained porn room that had VHS porn. So I really loved that place. And you know, when they sold the building and they were doing their going out of business sale, they had like this. The thing is vivid in me. They had a big, like, laundry basket filled with VHS copies of mixed martial arts fights. And it was like 100 VHS tapes for $100. And I missed that. I missed that feeling in the community.
I think buying 100 mixed martial arts videos qualifies you to be on some kind of police watch list, doesn't it?
Yeah, they do. They have his pick.
One of the first things to go that I remember best is the old St. Vincent de Paul. Mm-hmm. I don't know if anybody... Oh, yeah. But it was kind of like the Pike Place Market. You rambled down this street, and they had different rooms or buildings for, you know, kitchen stuff. So it was like a market. And when you got down to the edge of the lake, there was landfill that kind of made a little peninsula. It was full of old toilets and bathtubs out there. It was like a sculpture garden of all of the things that wouldn't be destroyed in the rain. And you could go out and walk around a little boardwalk in the middle of Lake Union looking at 1906 toilets, that kind of thing. It was a very cool place.
So, Canute, you are the Mossback. How do you feel about the change to Southlake Union and other Seattle area neighborhoods?
Well, it's really funny because some of it has been great. I mean, if you look at the rim of the lake in particular, Gasworks Park was a great innovation. We still have the houseboats. I love the fact that Mohai is down here, the Center for Wooden Boats. It's become, interestingly, despite all the newness, it's become a kind of focal point for heritage and making heritage visible in a way that, you know, it wasn't when Mohai was out at Montlake. So I think that's a really positive side of it. A lot of the new development just leaves me cold. It just seems like Bellevue.
Well, you can't have this conversation without thinking about what could have been here with the Commons, that discussion, those two votes where Seattle just said no twice.
This was 1995, right? Seattle voters rejected this 60-acre park that would have stretched from north downtown to the lake. And wasn't the opposition, well, but it's going to ruin local businesses.
It was indeed.
And we wouldn't want that to happen.
It was indeed. And so at some point, folks were saying, wait a minute, you want to preserve all these parking lots and car lots? I mean, that really was the debate, that you would change this neighborhood sort of natural progression. But everybody knew the upzoning was coming. That was clear. So the question was, do you want upzoning with a park or with no park?
So do you wish we'd had?
I kind of do. I kind of think it would be great to have, you know, a green, big green space through the middle of the area, because otherwise, as these buildings go up and you keep seeing so many buildings are going so high, you're just not going to have that kind of relief.
Would there have been the development with the 60-acre park and the condos around it that were part of that development anyway?
They would have sold the park.
They would have sold the park.
You know, I'm a huge fan of density, actually. I think, you know, we should be living. I think the most environmental thing we can possibly do is live in high-density areas. You know, the Hopi did it for a long time, and the Pueblo people
did it. Pueblos.
Yeah, they managed to make it work for at least 10,000 years, so I think we should probably think about that. Think of South Lake Union as a really, really white Pueblo.
Very male, too.
Very male. Well,
very
actually,
male.
I shouldn't say it's very white. There's actually, I mean, it's probably one of the more diverse neighborhoods, actually, because of Amazon. I mean, East Indian and Asian folks. It's certainly, when I walk around, it's a lot browner than downtown Seattle, and yep, a certain way browner than Bellevue. So maybe we could think of it as a slightly more brown Bellevue. That's what South Lake.
Slightly more brown Pueblo.
Yes.
Sherman Alexie with us. We were asking you on Facebook to sum it up in one word, and we got a diversity, as you can imagine. One poster said, South Lake Union, ruined. Another said, beige. Another said, I don't know whether that's the skin or the...
It's to Sherman's point.
Glassy and Amazombies. Speaking of which, Knut, you wrote about the changes in Seattle historically, and you came up with a word that I hadn't heard. Amazon, what did you call them?
Chichacos?
What's chichacos?
Oh, well, that's an old word that came about. It was used during the gold rush to indicate newcomers, newbies, chichacos.
My word was treacherous because I moved away for a while. When I lived here, I moved away in 04, and it used to be, you know, South Lake Union was a place that you went through. You know, you're just trying to get to REI, or you're just trying to get, you know, to some place. And so I would kind of roll through those stop signs, you know, with the chunky bricks on the streets, and it was deserted. And now, you know, I come back, and I'm still in a bit of that mindset, and there are dogs and bicycles and dogs on bicycles and guys, usually guys with the badges, chatting with, you know, either on their cell phones or with each other, who are walking as if cars, you know, didn't exist. And I, you know, did I just hit a trolley? And it's, I think it's great. I think it's great, but it's
supposed
for
to
me,
keep your car between
I'm
the
old
lines.
And
supposed to keep your car between the lines, if you know what I'm saying.
Keep
that's
it between
why
the lines.
You don't hit the trolley.
I think the key in one of the places in the South Lake Union now that sort of sums it up for me is there's an upscale Goodwill.
Upscale Goodwill. Yes, the Goodwill is well appointed.
It's very selected.
Yeah.
You walk in and it's from their donations, they have grabbed the absolute best of clothing and household items, and it's in this store on South Lake Union, you know, amidst the amazing restaurants and Chipotle and
yeah. I think those Amazon pedestrians assume that I'm in a remote driverless car so that I'm not going to hit anything. We've got more to talk about here on KUW's Week in Review, and we're in South Lake Union. I wonder if anybody in our live audience at the Center for Wooden Bows, does anyone live or work in South Lake Union? Just a couple. So is it true that Whole Foods is a civic gathering place? I've heard from more than one person that the place to be is Whole Foods. That's the center of the neighborhood. Yeah, could be. We do know that they're providing treats and coffee right outside the door as we do KOW's Week in Review Live, and we'll be right back. I'm Bill Radke. KUOW's Week in Review is live at the Center for Wooden Boats in Seattle's South Lake Union, and the record will spin right here in just a little over an hour. The record begins at noon, live here from the Center for Wooden Boats, right amid the halibut schooners and the sloops and the yachts, and the Virginia Five is in the audience back there, and it's great to have you with us with Knut Berger and Joni Balter, Sherman Alexie, and Luke Burbank just joined us. Lucas.
Hello there, Hello. Bill.
Luke of Livewire, of TBTL, Too Beautiful to Live.
Mm-hmm. Too beautiful for most of these people to have heard of, but I don't want to hold that against them. I love this place, Bill, by the way. I would frequently, when we lived in Seattle, come and just sort of wander around here because this place is so aspirational for me. I look at these boats, and I want to be the kind of salty, rough-hewn man of the sea who just planes some block of wood all day and isn't checking Twitter to see if anybody
noticed?
Retweeted a picture of him planing a block of wood. But.
Well, you need to come to the AA meetings down here. It's those guys and me, so.
I didn't know they had a meeting here.
Yeah, so.
Kismet on our panel, Sherman Alexie and Luke Burbank have played many a pickup basketball game together, a team hoops game together where he played at the church.
That game has moved.
At the church? What does that even mean?
Yeah, isn't that where you play at?
No, I think that was a different friend of ours used to play. The Seattle Times would play at a church.
We play at Ballard High School.
This is fascinating for our listeners, by the way. But I bring it up.
That's 2 minutes of your life you'll never get back.
I bring it up because A, it's compelling radio. B, the sale of the Los Angeles Clippers to former Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer became official this week. Sherman, so you can not only write, you can set a hard screen. Who do you hate more, Greg Nichols, Howard Schultz, Clay Bennett, Kevin Durant, or Steve Ballmer?
That's no contest. That's Clay Bennett.
Okay.
I would hate Clay Bennett
more
anyway.
More than Schultz?
More than Schultz, because Clay Bennett's entire philosophy is based on destroying people, and Howard Schultz likes gay marriage.
Clay Bennett is like is Darth Vader, and Howard Schultz was just the guy Darth Vader strangles.
Yes, exactly. That's
mind powers.
Yeah. So what I enjoyed though about Howard Schultz is when he made that completely symbolic gesture about lawsuiting the whole thing. I enjoyed watching a powerful billionaire be weak and realizing that he had made a terrible moral, ethical, community-based error.
Well, speaking of big shots, Steve Ballmer was one of the big money bags behind the Bring the Sonics Back to Seattle movement. Have we all officially given up now on NBA coming back to Seattle?
Well, you better believe that him buying the Clippers is a big deal because the NBA wanted him as an owner. And so they're not going to want him as an, you know, what are they going to do with the Seattle group? The Seattle group doesn't have a Ballmer anymore.
Yeah, they don't have a Ballmer in this fight.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a long time before we get a pro basketball team. It's unfortunate that the NBA seemed to realize right after the Sonics left Seattle how important it is to keep teams in the cities where they are, because they've gone to great, great lengths. I have been walking around with this diatribe I was going to unleash on Howard Schultz if I ever met him, and my wife and I ran into him when we were walking our dog in Madison Park.
Yeah.
Two interesting things. One, he goes to the Starbucks in Madison Park
because he
had a cup. Cool.
Imagine working at that Starbucks where you know that Howard Schultz drops in regularly.
They wrote Howard on his cup.
Yeah.
Like he has to get in line and say his name, and then they call Howard, and then he goes and gets the cup of coffee. And midway through the conversation, I realized that this very fit guy with these beautiful dogs and his beautiful wife was Howard Schultz. And I played through all the stuff I've been wanting to say to him for all these years, and I decided to go with, those are beautiful dogs. completely wussed out.
The
so hard.
Esprit d'escalier. Yeah. Hey, final topic on KOW's Week in Review. I want to hear who can identify, you ready, Jason? Who can identify this sound of the week?
It is really unfortunate.
No, not that one. We're moving on. That was Steve Ballmer freaking out as usual. The sound of the week this week in Seattle across the country was a this'n.
Here we go. Okay.
Who can name that sound? Did anybody hear that in the live audience? Could you hear it? Okay, I'm seeing some nods. What was that noise? Not Blue Angels, no. Ice Bucket Challenge, yes, ma'am. That was Seahawks general manager John Schneider not being doused after his Super Bowl victory, but taking the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge. He did it. Hawks coach Pete Carroll did it. Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella did it and told Jeff Bezos and Larry Page of Google to do it. Everybody except the politicians, celebrities, not President Obama, have done it. Has this reached you, the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge?
I'm doing it on kind of a slower basis based on the rain today.
Yes.
It's over 8 hours. I'm slowly dousing myself in cold water in Seattle.
Well, don't you get dosed, or don't they put the ice on you if you haven't donated?
That's the weird thing.
Yeah. So they're going viral with all the famous people who haven't given them money.
That's one of the reasons for the backlash. So this is an old, I'll explain, this is an old generic like fundraising challenge, right? If you don't, do this over your head, then you gotta donate to whatever, and it encourages people. Well, the way it's gotten adapted by ALS. ALS, by the way, is a degenerative disease. Thank you. Which is has been around. It's fatal. It's been around so long that it has outlived the name Lou Gehrig's disease. I guess we've all decided that he's not even well known enough anymore. We've known about this for a long time, yet there is still no cure. So this old fundraising challenge tactic got adapted by ALS, the research arm, as a challenge. You either have to dump a bucket of ice water on your head or donate, and it's been various amounts, $50, $100 to ALS. It has raised $5.5 million for the ALS National Office compared to the $32,000 that they made last year, okay, just this month. And yet there is a backlash among, for one thing, that's weird that you're either dumping ice water on your head or you're donating. But another thing is that you don't care about ALS. You just want to post a playfully heroic video of yourself, possibly in a wet T-shirt. The ALS backlash.
Right, and they didn't do much explaining about ALS. It was all about see this three bags of ice on my head, and by the way, I'm in this hot bikini or something like that.
I raised a lot of money by telling people if they didn't donate, they would have to see me in a wet T-shirt.
Yes.
And that was very successful, I'm happy to say.
So are you guys the type who would do such a thing? Because I got tagged and I did a version of it.
What'd you do?
It's the last thing I would...
Your kids dumped...
Ice coffee.
Ice coffee over here. Yes. How Seattle.
That is so Seattle. Oh, my God.
But I am... You're at least two of you are Facebook friends of mine. I never utilitized the Facebooks, right? But I got tagged to do it. But there's a lot of people who are audibly... that you can hear the eye rolling about it. So I wondered how... This is on everybody's Facebook feed. How did you react? And if that's not you, what would it... what would it take for you to give?
I dump friends who send me things like that.
Yes.
That's unfriend.
I'm not on Facebook, number one, but when I have, there's maybe like 70 people in the world who have my email, and there'll be 68 if two of them sent me that tomorrow. So if my mom sent me that, I wouldn't email my mom anymore.
Sure, I want to tell you my email got hacked, and so you're going to be getting a lot of messages from me that I regret sending.
But what part of $5.5 million for ALS research is the part that you don't like?
I mean, I do a lot of fundraising and work with a lot of fundraising groups in Seattle, and the thing is, the effort is to sustain a movement, to sustain a fundraising effort, to create relationships with people who like to give money. So it's more like marriage. You're looking for marriages with people who are generous with their money. And this seems like a really sleazy one-night stand.
Really?
Unsustainable.
This is an indecent proposal of a one-night stand, for $5.5 million.
Yeah, so I'm glad they've raised the money, but it has done nothing to educate people. And I never bought a pet rock either, or one of those fake invisible dog things. Or
we have a chia pet for you.
I mean, I'm a 47-year-old father of two. I have life insurance. Pouring ice on me would be like dating a 19-year-old. That's my feeling about it.
Well, I was just thinking I have to do some fundraising for a time capsule project coming up this fall, and I've been kind of reluctant to send out those emails and stuff. So now I just need to think about what I can threaten people with. You know,
right.
I thought
dump
you were
a bucket
to
of pet rocks over your head and go directly to Harborview.
Hey, we're live with KUOW's Week in Review at the Center for Wooden Boats. Has this hour not zipped by like Luke Burbank's motorboat? We had such fun. I want to thank KUOW, of course, all the team, you know, the live events team who puts this all together, our operations team, our ops people, because this is kind of hard to pull off. I want to thank the Center for Wooden Boats, of course, and I want to thank you for coming on down. Did you have an entertaining and informative time? Will you stick around for the record, which will spin in an hour? We're live here all the first half of the day on KUOW. Final words, Luke Burbank, anything you want to plug or promote?
Well, tonight on LiveWire, which is 8 o'clock on KUOW, we have Ken Jennings.
Ah.
So that should be fun to tune in for.
Jeopardy man. Sherman Alexie, Joni Balter from Seattle Channel, Civic Cocktail, Knute Berger, the Mossback. I'm Bill Radke with Luke Burbank. Thank you for tuning in. Stay tuned for the record. Mm-hmm.